Today is Friday, August 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Taliban take control of another provincial capital in Afghanistan.
Morale has been so decimated. The support for the Central Afghan government has been so weakened in areas that they're seeing massive defections from Afghan national security forces.
Plus, a South Korean hospital has come up with a revolutionary way to test patients for COVID-19 and exploring a new archaeological find in Jerusalem. We'll have these stories and more next. Taliban insurgents on Thursday captured Afghanistan's strategically important southeastern city of Ghazni, bringing them a step closer to threatening the national capital of Kabul. Later on Thursday, Herat, the country's third largest city, also fell to the Taliban, according to an official speaking to VOA. Kandahar, Afghanistan's second largest city, was in the process of falling, according to the official, although the Taliban claimed late on Thursday to have taken the city. That information was also reported by various wire services. Bill Roggio, senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, told the Associated Press that the Afghan military is fighting for a government that many see as being corrupt and one that is not giving them the resources they need to have success on the battlefield.
So the motivation for the Afghan military to fight hard and fight to the death for the government are very, very low. Meanwhile, they're going up against a force that has a very high morale because of its success on the battlefield and who believes it's waging war to establish the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, that there's actual religious justification. And if they die, they're dying to fight for a cause that is, that has religious justification.
Roggio says that mismatch is contributing to the Taliban's gains on the ground. That's something that Seth Jones, senior vice president at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, in an AP interview also agrees with, as the Taliban fighters have been able to seize provincial capitals without much resistance from Afghan security forces.
Morale has been so decimated. The support for the central Afghan government has been so weakened in areas that we've seen massive defections from Afghan national security forces.
Roggio also provided this strategic assessment.
The Taliban is taking out key nodes. The only way the Afghan government, the Afghan military can reinforce these areas to reestablish a beachhead, so to speak, and reinitiate the fight against the Taliban in these far-flung provinces would have been via these airports, and the Taliban is beginning to deny it. It's key infrastructure for both the Afghan government and the Taliban. The Afghan government is not going to be able to roll convoys up into Kunduz City or out in far west in the Farah province. That just isn't going to happen because they're losing on the battlefield, and the priority now is going to be the defense of Kabul. Whatever forces are left are remaining that are in the Kabul area and in the provinces around them, they're going to be used for the defense of Kabul. The provinces at this point, unless something dramatically changes, and I don't see how that's possible, these provinces will remain under Taliban control.
Speaking to reporters at the U.S. State Department, spokesperson Ned Price announced on Thursday that the U.S. is reducing its personnel at the Kabul embassy because of the deteriorating security situation.
This is what we do for every diplomatic post in a challenging security environment. Accordingly, we are further reducing our civilian footprint in Kabul in light of the evolving security situation. We expect to draw down to a core diplomatic presence in Afghanistan in the coming weeks. In order to facilitate this reduction, the Department of Defense will temporarily deploy additional personnel to Hamid Karzai International Airport.
The U.S. Embassy in Kabul also says in a notice that was posted on its website, the U.S. citizens should leave Afghanistan immediately using available commercial flight options. Hamid Hakimi, who is a research associate in the Chatham House's Asia-Pacific program and Europe program, says everyone in Afghanistan wants the conflict to end and the violence to stop.
That is going to be the biggest problem people face immediately, more than the kind of challenges associated with a potential brutal Taliban return. So from what I understand, the violence is unbearable, and that's more of a priority for people that I speak to, that they want to stop.
In Kabul, VOA's Aisha Tanzim recently met with people displaced by the war and shares a story of the horrors that they saw.
Poverty, desperation, homelessness. This is the human face of this war. Many of these people had homes, lives, loved ones. Now, nothing. Rahima, who like many in Afghanistan uses only a first name, is aimlessly roaming around an IDP camp in Kabul, waving her husband's ID card.
In Baghe Shirkat area, a rocket landed on my home. My husband was killed. My kids were killed. My entire house was destroyed. What should I do? Where should I go?
In Afghanistan, her story is hardly unique. In the last couple of months, Taliban attacks have increased and fighting has intensified. In the last few weeks, the fighting has reached cities, affecting even more civilians. This is an IDP camp in the middle of Kabul. These people from Kunduz, tens of thousands of families, had to leave their homes and everything behind once the Taliban attacked. The United Nations reports a 50% increase in civilian casualties since May. They will only go up as more cities are attacked, as will the number of displaced. Student Bashir Ahmed fled when militants entered his home.
Taliban surrounded us from all sides. They even entered our house and took positions inside our house. That's when we decided to leave and save our lives.
Even as Ahmed was sharing his story, another man, obviously distressed, with tears in his eyes, jumped in, almost causing a fight.
I lost my brother. My father is wounded. My other brother is wounded. I have no money to rent a car and bring my family here. I have no ID card, so they are not even letting me in the camp. You're talking about a month ago. I am just talking about yesterday. It's a massacre. A massacre.
His rant brought tears to the eyes of these young boys. Some of them have faced their own horrors. The fighting in the country is fast becoming urban warfare. The head of the United Nations in Afghanistan warns that it runs the risk of becoming the biggest catastrophe of this century. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Kabul.
The U.S. Census Bureau has issued its most detailed portrait yet of how the country has changed over the past decade. AP correspondent Ben Thomas is up next.
The 2020 census figures show continued migration to the south and west and population losses in the Mississippi Delta and Appalachia. But the Bureau's Mark Perry sees a shift in the patterns.
Most states in the west continue to be in the fastest growth category, but this is no longer true in the south. In that region, only five states and the District of Columbia were in the fastest growing category.
The numbers also indicate the white population of the U.S. is aging and has fallen to its smallest share of total population on record, while the nation's population under 18 is increasingly diverse. Overall, Perry says the last decade saw the second slowest population growth on record.
Only the 1930s had slower growth.
Ben Thomas, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Australia's capital city of Canberra is going into a snap one-week lockdown from Thursday evening after reporting its first locally acquired case of COVID-19 in more than a year. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson takes it from here.
There was panic buying at the supermarkets in Australia's capital, Canberra, on Thursday. Authorities said the new measures were needed because they were unsure how the man in his 20s acquired the virus. Chief Minister of the Capital Territory, Andrew Barr.
We do not currently know the source of the infection, but extensive investigation has been underway for many hours. This is the most serious public health risk that we have faced in the Territory this year, and really since the beginning of the pandemic.
Australia's two largest cities, Sydney and Melbourne, are already in hard lockdowns as the country tries to get on top of the fast-spreading Delta variant. The government has announced it may deploy extra military personnel in Sydney to ensure compliance with the rules. Despite 7 weeks of lockdown, daily infections there continue to hover near record highs. New South Wales on Thursday reported 345 new locally acquired cases, up from 344 a day earlier. In neighbouring Victoria, 20 new cases were reported, and residents in Melbourne were preparing to enter their second week of lockdown. Experts see Australia heading into a cycle of stop-and-start lockdowns until a higher vaccination coverage is reached.
Flora Bradley-Watson reports for Reuters News. As Britain is enjoying a summertime lull in COVID-19 cases, the nation's attention has turned to the end of pandemic-related restrictions and holidays in the sun. AP correspondent Zaria Shackley has that one.
But scientists are warning the public not to be complacent, saying high levels of infection in the community are likely to lead to another spike in cases this fall. The reason for their pessimism is a Delta variant of COVID-19, now dominant throughout the UK. Vaccines are less effective against this more transmissible variant, meaning Britain needs to achieve a much higher level of vaccination if it hopes to control the disease. About 60% of the UK population has been fully vaccinated. Zaria Shakili, London.
And since the Delta variant is more transmissible than the Alpha, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, says that more children are likely to get infected, and in turn, a small percentage of them will require hospitalization.
So quantitatively, you will see more children in the hospital. Regarding the severity of illness, there was a couple of studies, mostly international, which suggested that Delta was more severe in adults, namely causing more relative percentage of hospitalization and more severe disease. With regard to children, this could possibly be the case, but we are not seeing this in a definitive way. The only thing we know for sure is that more infections mean more children will be in the hospital.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky, the director of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, also says that the best way to protect young children not yet eligible for vaccines is for their parents to get inoculated. A South Korean hospital has come up with a revolutionary way to test patients for COVID-19. Reuters reporter Lauren Anthony continues our coverage.
A South Korean hospital has come up with a revolutionary way to test patients for COVID-19. It has turned a testing booth into a mobile, contactless clinic. Patients enter rooms that seal automatically to reduce the spread of pathogens. Nurses can then reach patients through windows fitted with rubber gloves, and doctors can speak remotely via video. Telemedicine for basic treatment can also be accessed in the booth. Previously, patients with fevers or respiratory symptoms had to wait long hours to see a doctor and had to be isolated. Here's Lee Mi-yun, the director of Hallam University Medical Center.
It is very difficult for people with fever or respiratory symptoms to get professional medical treatment due to the coronavirus situation. But we've solved this problem by installing a glove wall where patients can see and hear well.
Hallam Hospital developed the one-stop clinic to protect staff, freeing them from the burden of wearing full-body protective gear in the sweltering heat. Some nurses, like Jung and Seoul, are still needed on-site for basic COVID-19 testing or temperature checks. But they no longer need to put on high-protection gear, gloves, safety glasses, face shields, and chemical-resistant boots.
The hardest thing was the hot weather, but I also couldn't communicate with patients, and it was hard to breathe. It's really good as I don't need to wear level D personal protective equipment. I was not able to use the bathroom easily or eat any food with PPE. But now it's really nice that I don't have to wear uncomfortable level D. So I can use the bathroom and eat food, and I can communicate well with the patients through the microphone.
Hallam's hospital director says the technology could even serve as a treatment system in countries where doctors and medical resources are more scarce.
Lauren Anthony of Reuters News. The Turkish capital has been hit with a night of violence against Syrian refugees. Turkey currently hosts over 4 million refugees, and with more coming from Afghanistan, there's growing fears of rising social tensions. Dorian Jones reports.
Hundreds of people attacked the homes of Syrians Wednesday in Altındağ, a suburb of Ankara. Syrian shops were also targeted, with an angry mob looting the contents. The violence was triggered by the killing of a local Turkish youth, allegedly by Syrians. Police tried to intervene, calling for people to return to their homes, but to no avail, as the violence continued for many hours. Unconfirmed reports say people travelled across the city to join the attacks. No official figures have been given on injuries. Altındağ, a suburban electoral stronghold of the ruling AKP party, is home to many Syrian refugees who had fled Syria's civil war. A local shop owner, who did not want to be identified, said people's patience over the refugees is running out. Let them go back. They are everywhere, left, right, center. He adds, I'm only one of three Turkish shop owners left here. Turkey opened its door to millions fleeing the decade-long Syrian civil war. But political analyst Attila Yeşilada of Global Source Partners says there is growing discontent over the government's refugee policy, which is likely to be exacerbated by increasing numbers of Afghans fleeing the Taliban arriving in Turkey.
There are not only 3.6 million Syrians, there are at least 2,000 Iranians, 500,000 Iraqis, an unknown number of North Africans, which came through tourist visas. Now Afghanis are coming in, along with other Central Asian nations, and they are, you know, virtually stealing jobs because they are willing to work for half the minimum wage. They don't complain. They don't stage strikes. So not only in Istanbul and other industrialized cities, many Anatolian towns, they are favored for manual jobs and agricultural jobs. This is a huge problem. All the previous polls showed that regardless of party, Turks want them to go back.
Main opposition politician Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu declared last month Syrian refugees would be returned within 2 years of his party coming to power. Wednesday night, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said measures were being taken to control any surge in Afghan refugees.
Bakın bizim şu anda gerek İran kapısından gerek Irak'tan.
Erdogan said at the border with Iran or Iraq, walls on the frontiers are rising significantly right now. These walls are to prevent illegal migration to our country. Turkey is constructing border walls and fences along its entire Iranian and Iraqi borders. Those barriers are predicted to be tested as observers warn of a potential exodus of Afghans if the Taliban take power. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Amnesty International said this week that Ethiopian government forces and allies have been systematically raping and abusing hundreds of women and girls in the Tigray region. Ethiopia's foreign ministry responded, criticizing the report as being based on a flawed methodology, saying that the group made sweeping and far-reaching conclusions that could hardly be supported by the limited and remote investigation. Ethiopia has previously acknowledged instances of sexual violence by some members of the armed forces. The extreme heat in the Mediterranean region is continuing to trigger wildfires, with dozens of people being killed in Algeria, Greece, Italy, and Turkey in recent days. The weather system, nicknamed Lucifer, has unleashed record temperatures and is now moving slowly west toward Spain and Portugal. Fire crews say the forests and fields, which have been baked to a tinder by intense heat, are easily ignited by a discarded cigarette or even a shard of glass that can magnify the sun rays. The United Nations and African Union urged Somalia on Thursday to hold already delayed national elections this October despite attempted intimidation by Islamist militants. The United Nations political mission in the country has recorded the deaths of 321 civilians this year, mostly attributed to Al-Shabaab. parliamentary and presidential elections have been repeatedly delayed since February over disagreements between the government and the opposition. A supply ship arrived at the International Space Station Thursday. Among the supplies delivered was material simulating moon dust and dirt that will be used to create items from the space station's 3D printer to explore how building materials may one day be created from resources found on the moon and Mars.
This is Science in a Minute.
Even the most prolific songwriters can get severe writer's block when it comes to developing lyrics for a song. A team of researchers from Waterloo University in Ontario, Canada, say they have developed a new system that uses artificial intelligence to provide the help songwriters may need to write their lyrics. Called Lyric Jam, the creators of the system say it relies on different characteristics of the instrumental music fed into it, like its rhythm, chord progressions, and instrumentation. From these aspects of a song's music, the system creates lyrical lines that reflect its mood and emotions. Lyric Jam's creators point out that their system doesn't actually write songs, but it provides creative inspiration that the composer can use in penning a song. If you're a songwriter and want to try out Lyric Jam, go to the system's website, lyricjam.ai. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Researchers in New Zealand have developed new technology that can make bridges more resilient to earthquakes. Their so-called low-damage solution has a series of rocking bridge columns that move with seismic shocks, leaving bridges with little to no damage compared to conventional building methods. Phil Mercer has those details.
More than 900 bridges were damaged during the Kaikoura earthquake on New Zealand's South Island in 2016. Roads and railway lines were also destroyed, disrupting the transport network. Researchers at the University of Canterbury have said that although current designs prevent the collapse of bridges, significant repairs might be needed. They've developed flexible columns made of high-strength steel that move during an earthquake. They act like giant rubber bands to bring bridge supports back into position. Conventional steel bars are also used to dissipate seismic energy, reducing the impact of a powerful tremor. Alessandro Palermo is a professor in structural engineering and materials at the University of Canterbury. He says the technology makes bridges more resilient.
This special steel, which is usually placed in the middle of the column, is actually working as a rubber band. So during the earthquake, this high-strength steel is actually trying to bring the pier back to the original position. And we're actually trying to combine these resilient solutions, seismic resilient solutions, with accelerated bridge construction. How can we actually build bridges faster and at the same time resilient? This system allows to do that.
In February 2011, the New Zealand city of Christchurch was hit by a magnitude 6.3 earthquake. 185 people were killed and several thousand injured. A decade later, rebuilding work continues. Each year, more than 15,000 earthquakes are detected in New Zealand. Only about 150 are large enough to be felt, but building homes, offices, and bridges that can withstand major tremors is a priority. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Hawaiians are turning to traditional practices for insights on coping with climate change. As Michael Sullivan reports from Honolulu, they're seeking inspiration from the past to achieve sustainability in the future.
Rising ocean waters are causing erosion, threatening coastal Hawaiian homes. Oahu, the state's principal island, could lose 40% of its beaches from erosion by 2050, says one study, harming tourism, the largest source of income for the islands. Another problem, higher temperatures are causing erratic precipitation and, in places, drought.
Some rainfall is on average going up over time, some is going down. In Hawaii, we've actually seen drying out.
With less stable weather, the islands are seeing more severe storms and flooding, as in Maui in March. There are other impacts, too.
Groundwater wells near the coast, agriculture, infrastructure.
A modern urban center, Honolulu, has paved over waterways to control flooding, blocking natural watersheds that once linked the mountains, wetlands, and coast in a single ecosystem. Native Hawaiians called it Ahupua'a.
And we're standing in front of an Ahupua'a. And the Ahupua'a was the Native Hawaiian system of managing resources from ridge to reef.
Hawaii now imports most of its food, but there are efforts to renew traditional farming and conservation methods, including here on the eastern or windward shore of Oahu. Nick Rapoon works for a nonprofit group that grows traditional staple foods like taro and is restoring this lowland area to its natural state. Other groups are restoring the mountain watershed and an aquaculture pond where Native Hawaiians once raised fish.
We're just trying to do what we know has been done and what we know worked before. We're not reinventing the wheel with these systems. We're just trying to, I guess, revive them.
Alapaki Luke, who teaches Hawaiian language and culture, says taro patches trap silt and control erosion, something Native Hawaiians understood. That traditional wisdom is important, he says.
I'm not about going back 400 or 500 years ago, but we can use the foundation, which you call a kahua, of the Ike, the Native tradition, in a modern setting.
Luke says the traditional practices that once supported a population of hundreds of thousands on these islands still have much to teach us. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Honolulu.
And finally, Israeli archaeologists say that new findings in Jerusalem's Old City are among the most significant that have ever been discovered. They believe a large building they uncovered is a city hall from 2,000 years ago, where dignitaries could relax before visiting Jerusalem's Second Temple. Linda Gradstein rounds us out.
There is the above-ground Jerusalem with its ancient holy sites, and there is the below-ground Jerusalem. That below-ground Jerusalem just got more interesting with the discovery of a large underground hall that helps bring alive the history from 2,000 years ago.
We are currently actually in the middle of the Second Temple period. It's like, imagine to yourself, time machine. It's the whole immersive experience. And one of the only places in Israel when you're not like just, okay, this stone is from the Second Temple time, or this wall is not. No, this whole area, we are surrounded by the Second Temple period.
The immense rooms were used as a triclinium, or a rest area for Israelite dignitaries on their way to the temple. The rooms will be a new feature on the route of the Western Wall Tunnels, an archaeological site adjacent to the Western Wall. The wall is the only remaining part of the Second Temple complex destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans.
These latest excavations have revealed the building that was built here, next to the wall to the south. And it was one of the fanciest buildings from that time. We are very close to the Temple Mount, which is one of the most important and holiest places we have. And it makes sense that we are finding such impressive buildings here.
The most recent excavations were a partnership between Shachar Puni's Antiquity Authorities and Shlomo Tal's Western Wall Heritage Foundation.
Their job was to understand what is happening here, and our job is the storytelling, to tell the story, to bring a person into being inside the time of the Second Temple with all the challenges of it, or with all the glory, with all the challenges before the destruction and the destruction.
Before the COVID pandemic shut down tourism to the Western Wall Tunnels, more than 150,000 people visited every year. Few foreign tourists have been able to return, but Israelis are coming to explore these impressive new discoveries. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.